We'll get started, I think, because quite a bit I want to try to cover this last session. I'm Joel Muggy. Once again, finishing up our series on Central America, this session entitled U.S. Foreign Policy Toward Disaster or Dialogue. Before I begin, I want to mention again is if anyone wants to be on the mailing list of the Center for Global Service and Education, which I direct in Minneapolis, please come up and sign up on this pad of paper, and among other things, through that you'll be kept informed of all of the study trips which we run to coordinate to Latin America, if you have any interest in that, and would be on a regular bi-monthly newsletter. Maybe just pass it around. Bi-monthly newsletter that tries to help keep you current on some of these issues and resources and so forth. All right, this week, I don't know how many of you have been here through the whole thing, but let me try to summarize very briefly what we've been trying to look at various dimensions of the struggle for liberation at work in Central America and U.S. foreign policy in the light of that struggle. And what I'd like to do is just in 3 minutes briefly review the central ingredients of U.S. policy in each of the countries in the region, like about two sentences on each one. What is the nature of U.S. foreign policy in each country in the region? In El Salvador, which is the smallest, most densely populated country, the U.S. virtually feeds, clothes, equips, and trains the Salvadoran armed forces and essentially directs the war against the armed rebels in El Salvador, who have, and this is important to note, the support of the vast majority of at least the rural poor, the rural population of El Salvador, and a significant sector of the urban poor as well. Furthermore, the regime which the U.S. supports in Salvador continues to tolerate outrageous violations of human rights, including torture, murder, including the murder of innocent men, women, and children. At the same time this is happening, the Reagan administration continues to certify, as they did, I believe, last Friday, and they have to do each 6 months, an improvement in the human rights situation in El Salvador. Those who have been in El Salvador say that that kind of certification is simply, it's irrational. I should mention in that light, I was with a group that visited with the Salvadoran ambassador to the United States in Washington at the Salvadoran embassy about a month ago. And he essentially admitted that the government does not have control of the armed forces. The civilian government in Salvador does not have control of the armed forces. I could hardly believe my ears that he was actually admitting this, but he did. In Guatemala, which is, of course, the northernmost country in Central America, the Reagan administration is pushing for the reinstitution of military aid, which was suspended by the Carter administration. They're pushing for the reinstitution of military aid to the, quote, born-again leadership of Rios Montt because of what the United States government says is Guatemala's improved human rights record, while at the same time reports of massacres of whole villages, we keep hearing these reports of massacres of whole villages in the rural areas of Guatemala, villages that are suspected of hiding or sympathizing with guerrillas in the mountains. In Costa Rica, a faltering economy forces the government to seek increasing U.S. economic aid. Of course, Costa Rica has always been held up as a sort of a model of democracy in Central America. And the price that Costa Rica is having to pay for this increased economic aid is to accede to U.S. policy, U.S. foreign policy directives, which mean increasing militarization. That is, the U.S. government is putting pressure on Costa Rica now to develop a military, an army, where there never was one before in Costa Rica, and is being encouraged to take a more hostile posture toward Nicaragua. Honduras, as we discussed yesterday, has become the kingpin of U.S. foreign policy in the region. Democracy is being undermined in order to develop a solid staging ground for the protection of what I consider to be, and many consider to be, repressive governments in Salvador and Guatemala, and for the overthrow of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And as some of you may know, I have indicated earlier in the week, just one more step in this process was has been the decision to send 4,000 U.S. troops to Honduras early this week in preparation for what are called maneuvers, military maneuvers. And finally, this against Nicaragua, the U.S. is clearly engaged in a covert and not-so-covert war intended at overthrowing the Sandinista regime. In this regard, the United States policy is to use other countries, particularly Honduras and to a limited extent Costa Rica, to carry out that policy. So that's just a quick overview. I mean, that's by no means... we tried to deal with that in more depth during the week. But today what I'd like to focus on are three questions, really. What are the reasons for the kind of foreign policy that essentially I've been outlining this week and we summarized here? What are the reasons for the U.S.'s position in this regard? Secondly, what are the consequences or the potential consequences of that position? And third, what might be some alternatives? In other words, is there another way that we could carry out our policy? Why is the United States responding the way it is? The natural first response to that question, as some of you have indicated and asked this week, is to suggest that we are trying to protect U.S. economic interests. And while I don't want to eliminate that as a reason, it should be noted that U.S. economic interests in Central America are not great. The annual trade with the region is around $1.7 billion, which is not high in terms of amounts of trade. Direct U.S. investment amounts to several hundred million dollars, and commercial loans from U.S. banks are mainly short-term kinds of loans, to get one year's crop out or so forth, and so are therefore relatively recoverable. There are not a lot of natural resources in Central America. Again, these are all relative now, relative to other parts of the world, except with the possible exception of Guatemala, where there are moderate oil reserves and the discover of some quite substantial nickel reserves. While economic interests are not there, so economic interests are not therefore the primary motivation for U.S. foreign policy. However, to the extent that economic interests are involved, the Nicaraguan experiment, I think, is seen as a threat to the economic interests we do have in the region. Now, how is that so? And this, I think, leads to into the more critical reasons for our policy. The Nicaraguan Revolution is seen as a beacon and a sign of hope to other liberation struggles throughout the region. This, I think, is the real threat, or the perceived threat on the part of the Reagan administration, and the single most important reason for U.S. concern about Nicaragua and for U.S. policy in the region. In the struggles in El Salvador, if the struggles in El Salvador and Guatemala, and eventually, I think, Honduras, I think we're going to see more and more revolutionary struggling in Honduras. If these struggles are successful, then the kind of economic and political and military stranglehold, and I don't think that's an overstatement, which the United States has had on that region of the world would be broken. Furthermore, and I think it's very interesting to look at Nicaragua in particular, I think the U.S. seems willing to accept one of two possible outcomes with respect to Nicaragua. Its first choice, of course, would be to break the Nicaraguan Revolution and to really somehow secure the overthrow of the Sandinistas and to put a government in power that it could control, as it can the other governments in the region. Now, it would be better, I think, for the U.S. image if this could be a government that on the surface looks democratic, it's civilian in some way, but if that's not possible, a military government would suffice. The most important criteria is a government that we could control. Now, if it's not possible to overthrow the Sandinistas, and I think that there's it's more and more a possibility that it's not going to be easy to overthrow them. I think the administration is maybe beginning to recognize that. Then an alternative strategy is to push Nicaragua to become as totalitarian, as repressive, and as dependent on the Soviet Union as it possibly can become. So that, why would we want to do that? So that their credibility as a symbol of hope and as an alternative way, as a third way, so that, that the power of Nicaragua as a symbol is broken. So that we can say, as we do with Cuba, look at Cuba, right? They've just become a satellite of the Soviet Union. And we won't get into I don't want to get into a debate at this point about whether or not that's totally true or not. But the fact is, you know, we would like to be able to write Nicaragua off. So if we can't overthrow the Sandinistas, push them to become as dependent on the Soviet Union as possible so that they no longer are a force for an alternative model. Now, that's when you think about that, that's really, in other words, one strategy is to push them to become all that we accuse them of becoming, right? You see the twists of rationale that goes on. And this is not just that's not my own harebrained scheme. This has essentially been admitted by certain State Department officials, that this is part of the strategy.
Well, if they follow that policy, what are they truly gaining?
They have, we have to say, think it in how they would think. I don't think they've gained anything, right? But what do they think they have gained?
The State Department,
the administration, you're saying, right?
Yes.
I think they would say just what I said, that Nicaragua is no longer a symbol. Nicaragua, as it is now, you know, if Nicaragua is really a symbol, not only to the rest of Latin America, to Central America, but all of Latin America, and to many dimensions of the third world, of a country who has determined an independent course. And so what they've gained is the power to be able to say, see, any kind of socialist revolution that has any qualities of socialism whatsoever eventually becomes totalitarian and eventually becomes aligned with the Soviet Union.
I don't think the rest of them are going to be that dumb. I mean, I think it's really self-defeating.
Well, yeah. So do I. I agree with you completely. But I think that's part of the rationale. That if we can't overthrow them, remember, and well, I'll get to this, let me come back to that because of what I think is the mentality operating here. Furthermore, it's increasingly clear that foreign policy under the Reagan administration is based on an ideology of national security. An ideology that sees reality in such dualistic terms that all international conflicts are seen as manifestations of the struggle against international communism. Or more specifically, a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. And from this point of view then, one really has to try to put oneself into that point of view. Now maybe some of you don't have to stretch yourselves much to put you in that point of view. I mean, that maybe that is how you see the world. Then a country like Nicaragua that opts for a more socialistic form of government and chooses an independent course of development, all right? There's no question about what's happening in Nicaragua is more socialistic in its structure, but is most importantly choosing an independent course, or a revolutionary movement in El Salvador that proposes a similar program as that's been put forth in Nicaragua. These experiments then, these programs, can only be seen as serving Soviet interests. In other words, if you see the world in black and white, that there are only two possibilities, and that everything else is a shade of one or the other, then governments like Nicaragua or what's being proposed in Salvador can only be seen as serving Soviet interests. And furthermore, for the Reagan administration to even consider legitimizing a third way, all right, to even consider the legitimacy of a third way, as I've suggested, is what's really happening in Nicaragua, calls into question the very worldview and assumptions upon which its whole foreign policy is based. I mean, that it just to accept a third possibility cuts the ground out from under their whole view of the world.
Well, why do you think there's that view that you know, how countries becoming socialized instead of becoming communist, whereas like some Scandinavian countries are very socialized, mm-hmm. We don't view them as being communist.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it really does go into the kind of mentality of the people who are in power at this point. I mean, that it's a very, what I think, a very limited view of the world, a view of the world that, as I said, sees everything in right and wrong.
Is it because the Cubans have helped them and are close?
That's possibly part of the reason. But I think it's more important. I don't think we're really worried about Cuban aid. I don't think we're worried about things like press censorship. What we're really worried about is that they want to determine their own destiny. That's the bottom line, I think. They want to do what they want to do. And they're not willing to follow our foreign policy directives. They're not willing to do it like we want to do it.
Is it organized exactly the way the Russians do?
No, not at all. Okay. Finally, and this is a very personal view, I'll accept full responsibility for it, the character of this administration particularly, and I've said earlier in the week, I don't want to blame our whole foreign policy on this administration, I just think we're seeing right now an exaggeration of a trend that's been going for many years that's very dangerous, but I think the character of this administration is so chauvinistic, so arrogant, that it seems incapable of even considering that its positions and policies might be wrong, even though neither most of our allies in Europe agree with it. U.S. public opinion doesn't support it. I quoted the other day a ABC Washington Post poll that was carried out about a month ago, which says that the U.S. population opposes the overt, covert, whatever you want to call it, war against Nicaragua, 6-1. 6-1, U.S. public opinion is opposed. The U.S. public opinion does not support it, and the facts do not support our position. I mean, the verifiable facts don't support, you know, massive amounts of Soviet aid, all of these kinds of things, as we've talked about this week. The facts simply do not support our position, and yet the administration really, in some ways, firmly believes they're right, I believe. And I think this is characteristic of the Reagan administration on a number of issues. This belief in a sort of their infallibility, that they're simply not wrong, no matter what anybody thinks. I think especially with General Haig, we heard even some quotes of this line, sort of a disdain for U.S. public opinion. And we've heard quotes from Reagan, well, why don't you just let us do our job because we know how it should be. This kind of disdain for public opinion that I think is very, very dangerous. You have a question?
Statement that that type of philosophy is called groupthink.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at it, and it's been found in all the Bay of Pigs invasion, it's just not willing to examine an issue. And
right.
Within the group, anyone that sees any doubts, he cannot expand it or talk about them because he's excluded from the group.
Yeah, yeah. New question back there, or comment.
Good morning, Joel. I gave you that article.
I've got it too. Right. I don't want to say that there are no Soviet arms being shipped to Nicaragua. Okay, that I
use the term massive aid.
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's massive aid going to Nicaragua. I think the accusation often is the massive aid. What I'm talking about is the massive aid shipments from Nicaragua to El Salvador. That I think there's absolutely no evidence for. It's clear that Nicaragua is getting aid from the Soviet Union in arms. but it's also getting aid from many Western European countries. France has provided a great deal of military aid for Nicaragua. So I have no questions about the fact that that Nicaragua is getting aid from the Soviet Union, but they haven't tried to hide that either. What I'm talking about here is the charges of military aid from Nicaragua to as a conduit through to El Salvador. Okay. So these, it seems to me, are some of the basic reasons for U.S. foreign policy. But I think even more important than the reasons are the potential consequences of this policy. And I think the most important consequence of this policy is that it simply has not and will not work even to accomplish U.S. objectives. And why won't it work? I think it won't work because it fails to recognize the historic roots of the problems in Central America. First of all, that is the decades that the real causes of rebellion, revolution, are, as we discussed on the first lecture in this series, the decades of poverty and oppression of the people of the region. And U.S. policy, as it's currently being carried out, serves to worsen the condition of those people, not to improve it. So that's one thing that's going to happen. The conditions which are causing this rebellion, because of our policy, are being worsened, not improved. All right? And so the seeds of that rebellion are going to grow, not do otherwise. Secondly, I think U.S. policy fails to recognize, and this is a very critical one, I think, and it refuses to recognize the broad base of popular support of revolutionary movements in these countries. We tend to identify the enemy as a group of, as in El Salvador, 4,000 to 6,000 guerrillas, right? Well, if that were all it were, it should have been easy to sort of wipe them out by now with the massive aid that we've put in. The fact is that these armed groups have the logistical and moral support of hundreds of thousands of people in these countries. They are not unrepresentative of the people of the countries in which they're struggling. I think one of the real failures of U.S. foreign policy or blindnesses is to, and we hear this again and again from U.S. State Department officials that we visit with in the region, that these groups or the Sandinista government, in the case of Nicaragua, does not have the support of the majority of its people. I can't imagine who they're talking to if they really believe that, because one doesn't have to be out in the country very long to recognize the massive support that they have. Even if, contrary to the opinion that I've been expressing, that that U.S. policy could succeed, right? Let's assume that this policy, this military solution in Central America could succeed, that somehow we could stop the revolutionary movements, we could overthrow the government of Nicaragua. What would such a victory cost? And again, I don't think that's possible because of the reasons I just mentioned, but what would it cost? A victory over the revolutionary groups would cost minimally hundreds of thousands of lives, in addition to the almost 100,000 lives that have been cost already in the region in the last 10, 15 years. It would cost hundreds of thousands of lives, it would also disrupt on an even larger scale the economies of the region. It would essentially destroy the economies of the region. And while we can't even begin to compare the loss in lives with the loss in dollars in terms of morally, while the present policies have cost us millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars really to this point, the military defeat of opposition forces in Central America would cost billions of dollars. And we all know who would pay those billions of dollars, who has the resources to pay those billions of dollars. Now, obviously, in all of this, the most critical factor is the loss of life. A U.S. State Department official was quoted a little over a year ago as saying that the United States would be willing, I mean, it was a sort of a cost, the cost factor here, would be willing to lose 250,000 lives to stop the rebels in El Salvador. 250,000. Now, whose lives are those, first of all? It's not ours, right? But this was a quote. We were with the Assistant Undersecretary of State for Latin America in Washington last October. And the question was posed at the end of our discussion, how are we going to get out of this thing without blood on our hands? And the State Department official said, and this is a quote, "I don't think we can afford that luxury." So that there is a commitment within the State Department that, in my opinion, goes beyond the bounds of humanity and decency in terms of loss in life in this area. So, coming back, though, to the issue that I think U.S. policy simply won't work, while many oppose current U.S. policies on ethical and moral grounds, as I certainly do, I think a case can also be made, and a very important case, for opposing U.S. foreign policy on pragmatic grounds, that it simply will not work to accomplish even the administration's own objectives. Finally, I think that we have to recognize that a continuation of our present policy might not only lead to disaster in Central America. I think it's inevitable that it will lead to disaster in Central America and massive loss of life. But I think it holds the seeds, and some very ripe seeds, for worldwide conflagration. Let me suggest a scenario. And we're in even, I think, the initial stages of that scenario. The United States supports an attack of Nicaragua by Honduras, and or blockades Honduras in the process, possibly would blockade Honduras. Cuba breaks the blockade, as Castro has indicated they will already, committed to that, and in some ways is forced then to come to Nicaragua's aid. I mean, I don't think Cuba would have any choice but to come to Nicaragua's aid in a much more direct way than they have in the past. The United States then decides Cuba is part of the enemy. We've wanted an excuse for a long time to get Cuba anyway, and so we attack Cuba. Who is forced to come to the defense of Cuba? I mean, I think these are not unrealistic scenarios. And I think the seeds of nuclear war are just as ripe in the whole Central America crisis as they are in any other situation in the world. And so it becomes, we can't appeal to people on moral and ethical grounds, maybe it's time even on this issue we appeal to people on our own sense of self-survival. Because I think we're at that stage of danger in this arena. But even another consequence, I think, of our current policy in Central America is also the image of the United States that it reinforces in the rest of the world. Those of you who have traveled abroad and who have done more than just a tourist circuit are aware, I think, that. And this is a very hard thing for Americans to understand, the image that we have in the rest of the world. But throughout Latin America, we're beginning to hear the United States government now described as the enemy of humanity. This phrase is a phrase I've heard a great deal in Latin America, el enemigo de humanidad, the enemy of humanity. We don't like to think of ourselves as a people or as a nation. And one can certainly debate whether that in fact is true. I don't want to get into that. But the fact, there is some reason for that image being created. Okay, so if there's any question about my, yes?
Is Mexico enter as one of the players in this conflict, or do they have too many problems of their own?
Well, Mexico is certainly entering as one of the potential players in a settlement. Mexico's position on the Central American crisis has been one of very much in opposition to U.S. foreign policy, in spite of their relationship with the United States, their economic dependence on the United States. Mexico is one of the potential players in a negotiated settlement, which I'm going to be talking about next. But I think Mexico's opposition to U.S. foreign policy here, and you know, the opposition of most of the rest of the world, really, with the exception now with in Great Britain, has basically sided with the United States. But otherwise, there are not many people who side with our position. And of course, Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala do. But Mexico is in a very interesting position right now within this issue, I think. If, as I was starting to say before, if there's any question about how I view the present foreign policy, we can talk later, but I think I've been fairly clear about what I think are its potential consequences and its reasons. So, what's the alternative? If this is leading to the disaster that I seem to be claiming it is, what's an alternative approach? And I think there is an alternative approach. It's one that's been proposed again and again by various groups of countries and organizations. And I would like to talk just briefly about what that alternative approach might be. It certainly must be a political approach, which means a serious willingness to consider a negotiated settlement in the region. It's important to note here, I think, that for 3 years at least, there has been a steady stream of proposals to alternate approaches to policy in Central America offered by various governments and opposition movements. The opposition movement in Salvador recently offered to negotiate without preconditions the settlement in El Salvador. The Nicaraguan government, on its Independence Day, July 19th, last week, offered a whole series of peace proposals. That the initial response of the United States was the most positive it's been, but then we continued to send ships, we've continued to send 4,000 troops to Honduras. U.S. policymakers have generally either disregarded the proposals or have sought to nullify them by clothing their own militaristic solutions as in political dress, as we've done, is for example, with is promoting elections in El Salvador. What would a negotiated settlement in Central America involve? What would it have to involve? First, the U.S. role could not be that of a mediator, as in Camp David or something of that nature. We simply could not be a mediator. We are one of the parties, and we better recognize that. Some group of countries, either a group, the OAS, the Organization of American States, or a group of countries such as the Contadora Group, which is now trying to work at a negotiated settlement in Mexico, Colombia, Panama, and Venezuela. Some group of countries that could serve as some sort of neutral arbitrator would have to provide a mediating role. Secondly, a negotiation process would have to be comprehensive. That is, it would have to look at the region as a whole, and yet at the same time separate the region into its particular parts. Okay, does that make sense to you? We have to look at it as a regional issue, but at the same time we can't, the United States wants to just say it's a regional issue and not divide it up into its component parts. In other words, it would not be consistent to opt for negotiations in El Salvador while continuing to pursue a destabilization policy in Nicaragua. Is that clear to everyone? I mean, it's got to be a whole approach. Now, what would it mean then in each of these areas? What would happen if we broke it up? What might it look like? In El Salvador, the first object obviously is to stop the bloodshed and to initiate a political process whereby the Salvadoran people could make very well known their wishes and their concerns for a government. Now, what is not a possibility, if we're really talking about a negotiated settlement, is that the United States' notion that the opposition should lay down their arms and compete at the polls under the supervision of the same military that has been responsible for thousands of civilian deaths. That was essentially the nature of the election that was held last year and the election that's being proposed for this December. an election supervised by the military in which the opposition is supposed to be willing to take part. Right? And we all know the character of the military in Honduras, in El Salvador. And as I said before, even the Salvadoran ambassador says the government doesn't control them. That simply is not an acceptable means of resolving the conflict. A fair process would in El Salvador would involve far more than just an honest vote count. There would have to be a long period in which potential groups could take their case to the people in open discussion. And there would have to be freedom for people to express their views in the media, on TV and radio, in mass demonstrations. And only such freedom, I think, would guarantee a government representative of all Salvadorans, and especially the poor majority. And most importantly, and this is the downfall of so many of these situations, is that the results would have to be respected. Even if, as is most probably the case, the FDR and the FMLN, the resistance forces, won an election, which would probably be the case if the process were truly open, and that the results would have to be respected. Okay, now what about Nicaragua? Here it's important to examine, I think, what is to be negotiated and who the parties are that need to do the negotiating. The most visible part of the negotiations with respect to Nicaragua would be between Nicaragua and Honduras, I think, and might deal with border patrols, how many troops can be deployed on the border and guarding the border, a possible border peacekeeping force, the situation of the Mosquito Indians, as we've discussed this week. So it's ostensibly a discussion between Nicaragua and Honduras. But for such discussions to proceed, there would have to be a political decision where? In the United States, clearly, because it's the United States who is resisting a negotiated settlement between Nicaragua and Honduras. So while the discussion is between Nicaragua and Honduras, it's also between Nicaragua and the United States. And there'd have to be that kind of political decision in the States to allow that to happen. Nicaraguan objectives in such a negotiation would be an end to the not-so-covert war directed from Honduras. And peace for Nicaragua at this point would mean putting resources now directed towards defense into badly needed development within the country. The U.S. objective, I would think, in such negotiations would be to ensure that Nicaragua does not become aligned with the Soviet Union, and that it maintains a working relationship with its neighbors. And as I've maintained this week, that would be consistent with the desires and real interests of the Sandinistas. I've maintained that the Sandinistas really don't want to be dependent on the Soviet Union and do want good relationships with their neighbors. To the extent that the U.S. could prove Nicaraguan involvement in arms shipments to other revolutionary movements, those could also be topics for negotiation and discussion in a negotiated settlement. But also, as I've indicated, there is no public evidence of such proof at this point. But to the extent that the United States could produce proof, I think those would definitely be topics for negotiation. What is not, I think, up for negotiation in the relationship between Honduras and Nicaragua and or the United States and Nicaragua is the nature of the revolutionary nature of the Nicaraguan government, that the Nicaraguan government is in fact going to attempt a restructuring of society, nor is a negotiated settlement, nor is it a possibility, a sharing of power with the counter-revolutionary forces that have been attacking Nicaragua. I don't think that is an issue that's going to be in any way, shape, or form allowed into the negotiating process by the Sandinista government. What would negotiated settlement mean for Honduras and Costa Rica? I'll just say very simply there, I think, not dig into that too much, but in some respects, Honduras and Costa Rica would be the most immediate beneficiaries of a shift towards negotiations, as they could then focus more clearly on their own problems and not be subordinated to U.S. geopolitical or military aims. In other words, they could focus on their own situation and not be doing our job with respect to Nicaragua, and the other countries in the region. And finally, in Guatemala, there's really no proposals for negotiation at this point. But what we could hope for in our foreign policy, I think, is avoiding what promises to be a Salvador-like involvement. And we could hope that the U.S. government would continue to not aid the Rios Montt regime, that we could stay out of that and not aid them militarily as the Reagan administration is now proposing. Now, to me, all this sounds sort of rational. I mean, makes sense. I say, well, you know, why can't we proceed in this way? Why is the United States resisting such an approach? I think the reason that we're resisting, what do you think is the reason we're resisting such an approach? Let me ask you that.
Governments don't operate that way.
No, that's right. But there are situations where negotiated settlements have taken place. I mean, why are we not willing to negotiate?
Well, we lose any control we think we have.
We want to be Big Brother.
Yeah. I think what's implicit, in a sense, is in such an approach, there is definitely the possibility, and in fact the probability, that revolutionary movements will share the power, and that we're going to have leftist governments that emerge from such a negotiated settlement. We're going to have other governments like Nicaragua, if we're going to allow a truly fair process. Now, even some congressional critics of Reagan policy, and we're hearing increasing Democrats saying this, insist that leftist victories would be a defeat for the United States. There's a presumption that U.S. economic interests would be affected, and that these governments would nationalize foreign investment and national resources and so forth. Now, if we're going to really be able to push for a negotiated settlement, I think maybe that is a charge that we have to respond to. You know, what does it mean for us to have leftist governments in Central America? I mean, first the question is, what do we mean by leftist governments? You know, what can we tolerate that in our foreign policy? I think more basic is the fear that Marxist governments, where there is some Marxist philosophy, would permit the Soviet Union to gain a foothold on the mainland of this hemisphere. And that, I think, is probably the basic fear. As I said earlier in the week, most other governments in the world, however, do not take that point of view, including most Latin American governments. As I indicated earlier today, present U.S. policies are not rational from a strictly economic point of view, as U.S. investments in the region are not great. The main concern, then, is the possible threat to the security of this country by Marxist-led movements or Marxist governments. Now, I think it's important to review here some things that I said when I dealt with the origins of the conflict in the first session this week. First of all, I said that revolutionary movements in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua are the result of years of struggle by the people seeking to respond to landlessness, to their increasingly their declining living conditions, and to political repression. Secondly, Marxist guerrilla movements, to the extent that they're at work in Central America, are parts of a much broader opposition coalitions in which the Marxist dimensions are generally the minority. Thirdly, the main guerrilla movements at work in Central America arose independently of the Soviet Union and have had only sporadic dealings with Cuba. Kind of direct linkage back to Moscow. And finally, there's no proof that they are dependent on substantial shipments of arms or anything from the Soviet bloc countries, to which then they would be obligated. Okay, those are some assumptions that we're working with here and trying to understand what it would mean to have revolutionary governments in Central America. What could we expect from such a government? What could we expect from a, quote, leftist government in Central America? I think some of the clues to that can be had from looking at the first 4 years of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. We could expect, I think, a basic restructuring of society, of the economic system of these countries, with a process of gradual redistribution of land and wealth within the country. And I say a gradual process. That's certainly what we've seen in Nicaragua, but a gradual redistribution of wealth. I think we would see an incorporation of people into the tasks of change and development, that we would see a much great emphasis being placed on incorporating the people of a country into the process of change. And almost the first thing we would see would be massive literacy campaigns. Now, one of the things that the United States has a great deal of difficulty with, at least on the surface, is the issue of elections. Elections in themselves are not seen as central elements in a legitimate political process by most of these governments. For example, the critics accuse the Sandinistas of limiting political pluralism because they have not yet had national elections. The Sandinistas might respond to this by saying that traditional political party systems have served to mask real control by small elites. We might do such an analysis of our own political party system in that same light. Do we really have a real representation? I mean, we look at our own presidential choices. You know, what's the comments you hear about our presidential choices the last two or three elections? At any rate, certainly elections would we would expect elections to be part of a negotiated settlement in El Salvador, but elections only after a long process of incorporating people into the political process and a very open political discussion. Revolutionary movements, I think, are pragmatic enough, and they have certainly indicated this till this point, to know that they, whatever happens, they are still in the, quote, backyard of the United States, and their economic systems are tied to the West, to the Western economic system. They've got Western machinery, they've got U.S.-made machinery, European-made machinery. The United States would continue to be the largest market for their exports and the primary source of their imports. It would be very costly for them to switch to other forms of technology, very costly for them to switch to, say, Soviet forms of technology. And even if they diversify their economic relationships, that is, broaden them to include the socialist countries, it would certainly make sense to stay squarely within the Western economic system. It would just be insanity not to. Furthermore, the Soviet Union is neither in the economic position to, nor has the willingness to offer the kind of massive aid to any Central American nation, including Nicaragua, the kind of massive aid that they would need to break out of the Western economic system. They did it with Cuba only after the U.S. blockade. Cuba did not have intentions of becoming dependent on the Soviet Union, and it was only after the United States cut off any possibilities for relationships with Western countries that Cuba moved in that direction. Finally, it's certainly not in the interest of these countries to face the active hostility of the United States. It's costing Nicaragua, for example, an immense amount to counteract the current U.S. threat. It's not in Nicaragua's interest to face the hostility of the United States, and so Nicaragua is desirous to have good relationships with the United States, trade relationships, political relationships, and so forth. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that the success of revolutionary movements in Central America, which would mean probably more leftist-oriented governments, should they take power, would have every reason to reach an accommodation with the United States. I mean, it does not make any logical sense for them not to have good relationships with the United States. Now, it may not mean that, it certainly will mean that there be continued opportunities for U.S. business. It may not mean that they'd be able to make as much as they once did, but there would still be continued relationships and possibilities for U.S. business. Furthermore, from the other standpoint, the other side of the coin, there is no intrinsic reason why the United States should not reach an accommodation with the revolutionary movements in Central America. I mean, it makes sense for those governments to reach accommodation with the United States, so no reason why we shouldn't reciprocate. But in order for that to happen, at least three things would have to change in terms of U.S. foreign policy mentality. We would have to be able to distinguish between the long-range goals of the United States and the issues of the United States and the interests of a particular company which feared the consequences of a revolution. Because much, as we all know, much of U.S. current foreign policy is dictated by particular companies which fear what a revolution in a particular country might mean to their interests. In the case of Honduras, the United Fruit Company, would have all their lobbying forces out to try to stop any kind of negotiation with a leftist government in Honduras. So the United States State Department has to have enough vision and enough sophistication to understand that the long-range interests of the United States might be in conflict with the interests of a particular corporation, and that it's those long-range interests that have to take priority. Secondly, we have got to begin to realize that these are very small. I mean, look at them. The largest country is the size of Iowa. Nicaragua is the size of Iowa. They are small agro-export countries that pose no security threat to this hemisphere. And finally, I think the United States would have to be sophisticated enough to take a pragmatic approach to the situation in Central America rather than an ideological one. And I think our, as I indicated before, our whole foreign policy can be argued. I think we can argue that our foreign policy is very bad on pragmatic standpoints, not only ideological ones. I'd like to close and throw it open for discussion again by telling an experience I recently had. Jean and I had the opportunity to be in Germany this last spring and visited, many of you may have been there, the memorial of the Dachau concentration camp just outside of Munich. And at the exit to the museum in Dachau, is the statement inscribed there, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And that it was just a very profound experience for me to see that, having just at that point come back again from Nicaragua and seeing what I think is a repeating of our mistakes of the past in Central America, particularly the mistakes that we should have learned about in Vietnam, and that in essence we may be condemned to repeat those mistakes, but I think this time with even more tragic consequences, if one can imagine more tragic consequences than in terms of loss of life than what happened in Vietnam, and that inability of us of this country to learn from its mistakes is what gives me a great deal of fear. Here, first question here.
I asked you earlier in a week about Kissinger's little group, and you said you'd address it sometime. Now's the time, please. How does that fit in, and is there a chance, or is it stacked at that kind of
thing? I guess I'll give you my cynical response, and then... it seems to me it's an exercise that it's part of the process, I think, of what's been a pattern over the last 2 years of making it look like we're involved in some sort of negotiations or willingness to negotiate, but continuing our policy underneath that, our policy of harassment and attacks and beefing up increased military aid. Let me just say, I'm just not encouraged by that. I haven't seen enough of what his activity. I heard he was appointed, and I left, and I haven't been able to follow much of what's happened in the papers, so I can't comment on it.
But, you know, the man who negotiated and worked out the agreement so the CIA helped to overthrow Chile does not give me a lot of confidence in settling the situation in Nicaragua, to have him involved in this issue as well.
Or yes. Do you write for a congressman?
Yes, I'd say that's one thing. Some of you may not have been here yesterday. The House of Representatives. There is, let me say one thing about that. I think there is a sort of an agony within the soul of Congress that is saying, you know, this something is not right here. And the House of Representatives did vote day before yesterday, or 2 or 3 days ago, in a bill that demanded that the Reagan administration stop aid to the overt and covert war against Nicaragua. It has to pass the Senate, and that's unlikely.
So you're inside or outside of the country?
Right. Now, so it is seen as a tremendous political blow to Reagan, because it means people are watching what he's doing. So I think, you know, if your congressman voted for that, write and encourage him and say power to you. If he didn't, to write and give him as much hell as you can, and put pressure on senators. I mean, the Senate is what's giving Reagan his license in this area now. I mean, that's one thing. The other thing is to keep opening yourself up to other alternate views of what's happening in this area rather than what the mainline press is communicating. Question here.
Your reference to DACA to me brings out an anomaly that should be obvious if we think about it, in that we were totally committed to fight the totalitarian Nazi military dictatorship government oppressing the Jews, and in Central America we're supporting the military Nazi totalitarian government oppressing the peasants.
That's right. I mean, these are the same. This is the same mentality. These are the governments. I mean, there are even, and many of them have connections back to the Nazis. I mean, not just theoretically, but they actually have had relationships, you know. These are the same people. And it's certainly the same mentality. Yes?
This may sound cynical, but when was there ever a government presented the ideal moral posture in the history of the world?
No, I think you're right. I mean,
right.
No, I think that's a legitimate question. I don't think we have seen.
Well, I say we should abandon the process.
Right, right. I think this is why. Well, let me say. I'm going to come at it from. I'm going to give a theological sort of response to this. All right. One of the things that the church, the new church emerging in Central America and in Latin America, is beginning to say to us is, first of all, that we are political, and that we cannot not be political as a church. That we say by not saying something how we are politically. And one of the things that the church is beginning to say in Latin America is that as a church, we must come down somehow on the form of some way on the side of some form of socialism. Right? Now, that's pretty hard for most North Americans to take, right? But nevertheless, the church is saying that the values of the gospel have a greater potential of living within a socialistic system than within a capitalistic system. That's competitive. It's not focused on cooperation. All right? Now, we don't want to, we could get into a long debate about what is socialism, what's communism, and so forth. But that some society in which sharing and equalization and equal distribution of wealth is a priority. What that church is also saying, however, is that we should never come down on the support of some social system in an uncritical way. That the church is always calling any social system to become more human. And so that I think you're right in the sense that we're not going to find a perfect social system, but I think we can make some evaluative judgments about one social system being more humane than others. And as the church, when we see a system that's more humane, and certainly more
a reflection of the needs of the people and the desires of a particular people, that we ought to support it and encourage it. At the same time as the church being very critical of that all the time. You know? So, I essentially agree with you. There is no perfect social system, and yet it's not as if they're all equally bad. And they're all equally bad for all peoples. And that the same system is right for all people. I think that's another thing. That we seem to think that to allow another people to have a system different from ours threatens our own system.
Well, I don't buy that. I think Reagan thinks that he's opting for freedom.
Yeah, well, I think he does.
He honestly believes that.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
It's not
right.
Socialism versus capitalism.
Right.
Versus totalitarianism.
Right. But I think he also says that no kind of freedom is possible in a socialistic system. I mean, I think that would be part of his identification of freedom. I think there was a question over here. Maybe one more question, then we'll stop. If there isn't, or any. Yes?
About 2 months ago, I listened to the program CBS Face the Nation, and Senator Goldwater suggested that Cuba would make a nice 51st state. I just wondered what...
I wonder if he asked Cuba about that.
What do you think that he was?
Well, I think he's probably suggesting that we, at some point, I think Goldwater would probably like that we, he would like if Bay of Pigs to have succeeded, and that we would take over Cuba militarily and become a part of the United States. I'm sure that's his point of view. I think if he really believes that's a reality, he's really...
That would probably have one of the solutions to the Central American...
No, I don't think that'd be a solution at all.
It may.
Listen, I want to thank you all very much for putting up with what may for some of you have been some rather challenging points of view this week, and I have been very appreciative of your openness in hearing this. I hope, I said at the beginning of the week, and I'll say again, I hope you'll look at it as critically as what I say. Now let me say it differently. I hope you will look very critically at what I say. At the same time, I hope what I have said has helped you to look very critically at what the Reagan administration says. That you don't you don't take anything at face value with respect to the Central American situation, that you really start questioning what is happening in that region and open yourself up to all points of view. I really appreciated your openness to this, the chance we've had to dialogue, and I hope you'll let yourself continue to engage in that process with other people. So thank you for what for me has been a very, very interesting and fun week for me. So
thank you very much.